Wait a second for the IT to catch up. There we go. Good afternoon. As Dr. Wharton said, I'm Sarah Wells, Vice President of Women in Government. I'm actually sharing my presentation time with Katie, as she mentioned, and I'm going to give you an overview of the organization and talk to you about the development of our Challenge to Eliminate Cervical Cancer campaign. Then I'm going to bring Katie up here, and she's going to talk about an annual report we release on cervical cancer, as well as some of the state policies I know you all are interested in hearing about today. So let me just start off by telling you a bit more about Women in Government. We are a nonprofit, bipartisan organization of women state legislators across the country. If you're not familiar, there are about 1,700 or so women legislators, which makes up about a quarter of legislatures, so not 50%, but we're working on it. We have been around for about 20 years. This is actually our 20th anniversary year, which is really exciting for us. Our primary focus is on healthcare and education issues, although we do work on environmental and economic issues as well. But a fun fact for you is that it's something like 90% of women state legislators serve on either healthcare or education committees or both. So obviously that's where we have turned a lot of our attention over the years. As far as the structure of the organization goes, we are very much bipartisan. The board of directors for the organization is 50% Democrat, 50% Republican, current women state legislators from across the country. Our funding comes from a wide variety of sources, corporate, foundation, government, both state and federal, individual membership dues. And I always get the question about funding sources, so I did want to tell you up front that you can get on our website, womeningovernment.org, and see a full list of our funders. We are a $2.5 million operating budget and convene quite a few activities throughout the year. So to tell you a little bit about some of those activities, we actually have about 30 conferences around the country each year. Sometimes we go away for a couple of days and work on just one topic. Sometimes we cover 20 public policy topics in the duration of a conference. The objective of our meetings, and really of the organization overall, is to serve as an educational resource for women who are already elected into office. So we do partner with other organizations that are trying to get women into office, but we really work more with the ones that have already been elected and helping them to learn more about the issues that they need to legislate on for their constituents, as well as hoping to give them a leg up so that they can gain leadership positions within state legislatures. In addition to doing 25, 30 educational conferences each year, we also have several policy resource centers. Most of the state budgets are in some sort of crisis, and as you know, resources for state legislators usually are limited as far as professional development, and sometimes, and depending on what state you're looking at, they may not even have a really wide range of staff resources themselves to do research on a bill that comes up that they have to vote on. So our organization tries to fill the gap there a bit by providing resources through these centers. There are three right now actively open at Women in Government: the HPV and Cervical Cancer Resource Center, which I'll talk more about in a minute, our Access to Higher Ed Policy Research Center, and our Medicare Preventive Services, which we just launched a year ago. In addition to providing resources such as model legislation and research on an issue if a legislator calls us, et cetera, we're also trying to build partnerships. And that's one of the main reasons why we're here today, is not only to tell you what we're doing, but also to build partnerships to help us move these initiatives forward. So I've put up just a brief list of some of the groups that we've been working with in the last couple of years. So now the part that I'm really here to talk about, which is our Challenge to Eliminate Cervical Cancer campaign. So just to tell you how this all got started, we actually, in the 20-year history that Women in Government has been in existence, have done a lot of work on women's healthcare issues. We have had several conferences way back that talked about Pap testing and screening for cervical cancer. And then around the time that the HPV test was approved and the topic was back in the media and back on the radar screens of policymakers, we decided we needed to step up the educational piece again. We had a lot of legislators who, the very first meeting that we did a segment on cervical cancer, came up and said, HPV, HIV, what is this? I'm not really sure I know what this is. I'm a legislator, and myself, I've been going to this conference, and I've been getting my Pap test all these years, but I didn't know anything about HPV. There were a lot of questions that came up from policymakers. And so we decided to take the show on the road, really at the legislators' request, to get out there and do more education on cervical cancer. And as a result of that, we formed a cervical cancer task force of state legislators, and over the years we've included other folks as well, to not only be educated about cervical cancer, but to really put forth policy recommendations. And Katie, when she gets up later, is going to actually go through those recommendations with you. But the gist of the key messages of our campaign are, first and foremost, to ensure that all women are educated about cervical cancer and the virus that causes it, HPV. Ensure that there is access to advanced and appropriate screening and vaccination technologies and public health programs. One of the pieces I'll say right up front is we really take a comprehensive approach to cervical cancer elimination. So the HPV vaccine is a really key part of that, but screening is as well, and continued screening is important. So we've been, I think, doing our best to juggle those messages and making sure that we are comprehensive in our approach. And then, of course, our other role and our other message is to assist policymakers in evaluating current practices and policies throughout the states. So this is the mission statement you'll see up on the slide of our cervical cancer campaign. We officially launched it in January of 2004. Again, our goal is to provide constituents with access to most advanced and appropriate technologies, regardless of socioeconomic status. And we also really believe that policymakers play a tremendous role in all of this. So clearly, there are so many stakeholders in the cervical cancer elimination efforts, including public health and other advocacy organizations, but we do see a tremendous role and opportunity for policymakers. So to talk a little bit more about some of the educational tools that we have available, through our HPV and Cervical Cancer Policy Resource Center, I think one of the more successful elements has been our legislative toolkit. A key part of this is model legislation. And we really look to legislation that's already been introduced and passed in states to use as a model so that we know something that's been tried and true that will work. So the organization ourselves do not actually write legislation, but we go out and look for good public policy to use as an example. You know, one of the things you find working within our organization is that California is maybe not talking to New York about the programs that they've implemented there, but there's a tremendous opportunity to share best practices and learn from each other. Sometimes that's learning what didn't work, and a lot of times it's also learning what really does. So the legislative toolkit presents that information and really in a way that policymakers can use it effectively. So you'll notice if you look at it, a lot of the materials are brief, they're to the point, there's something that can be photocopied and replicated for their constituents. There's brochures and so forth in there that they can pass out. There's media talking points so they can be on cue when they're speaking with the public and the media. We also have educational materials out of the Resource Center. I mentioned brochures and fact sheets. Another key piece I want to mention is that Women in Government believes very strongly in evidence-based practice and outreach, and so we are always out there trying to get medical guidelines in the hands of policymakers. And not only just giving them the piece of paper that has the guidelines on it, but also making sure that they're working with practitioners and healthcare providers in their states. So you'll hear in a second, there's a lot of efforts that we have behind that. We have a toll-free hotline for policymakers, which I think is really exciting. It was the first of its kind. So we get a lot of calls from legislators who are literally on the floor of their House or Senate, and they're saying, oh, there's a bill on HPV, and I just don't know what this means. Can you help me? And so we try to help them by providing those resources and research. Again, in a few minutes, Katie's going to talk to you about our annual state-by-state comparison report on cervical cancer, which I think has been a really effective tool for the campaign. We also do a lot of HPV and cervical cancer-specific conferences. The first I'll mention is our Cervical Cancer Summit, which we've had the pleasure of having Dr. Wharton at several times. And we have actually been partnering with the CDC for a couple of years on this meeting. And the purpose of this is to, again, educate policymakers, but to start to bring in some of the stakeholders that our organization has not traditionally worked with. So that would be state agency representatives, members of the federal government, both policymakers and federal agencies, other wonderful advocacy groups working on these topics, survivors, industry, any of the folks that really need to be included at the table. And I think it's been really highly successful in creating partnerships and also spurring legislation. I mentioned our Cervical Cancer Task Force, which meets annually to release recommendations. And then pretty much any opportunity we have to get cervical cancer on the agenda of one of our conferences, we try. It's still, to this day, several years later after the launch of this campaign, of high interest, I think, to the policymakers. So I have to tell you, the next slide is actually, before I put it up, my favorite slide of this whole presentation, because it's going to show you the activity that Women in Government has had since 2004 around cervical cancer prevention. And I want to start by saying that I remember back in 2003 when we were thinking about how we would launch this campaign, the first of its kind for Women in Government, and we said if we had four states that would do something, make some kind of commitment to cervical cancer, that that would be a success for our organization. So as I put this up and you see that all 50 states have done multiple pieces of legislation in just the last few years, I think it's a pretty remarkable statement on the commitment of policymakers to address cervical cancer. So I'll leave it up there for a sec so you can see it. But, you know, again, we used to say 50 states, but then I thought we had to have a map that showed this because it's not just one piece of legislation in 50 states. As you'll see, there's HPV vaccine school school requirement laws that are out there, Medicaid coverage of HPV testing, cervical cancer elimination task forces, HPV testing insurance reimbursement, miscellaneous legislation like January as Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, HPV vaccine insurance reimbursement, HPV vaccine information programs and educational materials. there's just been a wide range of outreach and legislation on the cervical cancer topic. So again, I'm very excited to say that I think this has been a tremendous success for our organization. The next piece that we're getting into is our state-by-state cervical cancer report. And just to kind of set Katie up so she can go through that with you, this is, again, an annual report that we release. We started a few years ago. And similarly to our legislative toolkit, the idea behind this was to have an easy-to-read document that the legislators could really open up and see how is their state faring in the fight against cervical cancer. So it does go through each state specifically. They're interested to look at national statistics, but being more localized legislators, they also want to know what are the stats for their state, what do they need to take back to their constituents. So I think this has been a very successful initiative of ours, and you know, really the ultimate goal for us is to make sure that we identify gaps in state-level public policy and encourage the legislators to fill those gaps. So without further ado, I'm going to bring Katie up here and let her go through the report with you.
Thank you, Sarah. Good afternoon, everyone. Well, to start, this is the cover of our state report, just for your information. And I wanted to start by talking about the theme of the report. And this year, the state report for 2008 actually covers legislation and activities from the 2007 legislative session. So in 2007, we saw multiple challenges for state legislators on a variety of public policy measures. And that really turned into the theme of this report, which was turning challenges into opportunities. And I think the key here is the third bullet point, where we may find challenges along the way. We have already seen evidence that barriers can be turned into positive opportunities to help women nationwide protect themselves against cervical cancer. And so that was the driving idea behind all of the information in this year's report. Just quickly, I won't read these for you, but so you can see the 11 factors that were analyzed as a part of the report. And the next slide tells you how those were scored. Each of those 11 factors was scored from 0 to 2 points for a total of 22 possible points. And the states were graded excellent, very good, good, or fair based on their percentage or the number of points they received. These are the grades for 2008, and as you can see, there are a handful of states scored very good, with Minnesota leading the pack with 17 out of 22 points. But then there are also almost two handfuls of states scoring fair in the report, so there is much room for improvement in a number of states. And even in the states faring very good, there's still room for improvement. Some of the key findings: obviously, states continue to make progress. As you saw from the map just a second ago, most of the states received very good or good ratings in their efforts to prevent cervical cancer. With regard to HPV vaccination, more than half the states and DC took action to require the vaccine for school entry. I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. And 17 states introduced legislation requiring insurance coverage of the vaccine. 5 states enacted that legislation. Other additional points, scores ranged from a low of 8 out of 22 points, that's Idaho and South Dakota, and as I mentioned, Minnesota leads the pack, followed by North Carolina with 17 out of 22 points. Just a quick statistics on cervical cancer incidence. I think the key here is, again, the last bullet point, where a total of 31 states saw a decline in their incidence rate, while 5 states held steady. It's also good news that most of the states only received a score of 1, but those incidence rates are still quite high. On mortality, again, 26 states saw a decline in their mortality rate, while 8 held steady. So there is good news with this data, but certainly more work to be done. Again, Pap screening rates, there's some information in our report about why Pap screening rates are going down. There's some talk about whether or not that's with regard to the screening guidelines, which are increasing the intervals of Pap screening rates. So we're kind of waiting to see how the next set of data comes out to determine, is it because of the intervals or are women actually not being screened at a higher rate? Medicaid coverage of HPV testing is one of those policy areas that Sarah mentioned as part of our map of activity. And I wanted to point out here that while many of the states, most of them, cover unrestricted coverage under Medicaid for HPV testing, 4 states still place restrictions on HPV testing under their Medicaid programs. And this is just one of those examples where there's gaps in policy where advances could be made. And those states are California, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, and Tennessee. Health insurance coverage was another of the factors looked at through the report. And I point this out in particular because Women in Government is very strong in favor of making sure that all women have access to health care and health insurance, whether that be for general visits. We're proponents of general visits, and so you require health insurance to see those physicians, but also so that they're getting their coverage for screening and vaccination. And a particular of interest in this group are the teenagers or the college-age students who maybe are not eligible to be on their parents' insurance anymore but aren't working full-time and therefore don't have their own insurance. So that's a critical group of young women that we're concerned about, particularly as it relates to vaccinations and the HPV vaccine. So as I mentioned, I would bring back up HPV vaccine legislation. This is the map of the states that had introduced and Virginia and DC had enacted school requirement legislation for the HPV vaccine in 2007. I do know that Virginia's legislature this year has delayed implementation of that requirement, and the DC is also waiting congressional approval for their requirement to go into effect. As I also mentioned, again, 17 states introduced legislation requiring insurance coverage of the vaccine. 5 states did pass that measure last year, and a number of states are looking at this legislatively this year as well. Just an example of some of the types of legislation, Virginia being the only state that had last year enacted a bill to require the HPV vaccine for school entry at the middle school year. And I want to point out the last line of in this synopsis of the legislation that it does have an opt-out clause, and part of Women in Government's policy recommendations are supporting the current existing exemption laws in each state. We do not support changing exemption laws in the states for the HPV vaccine. I want to bring up the Utah bill because there's an interesting story that goes along with this piece of legislation. This legislation was introduced by the chair of Women in Government's Board of Directors. It directs the Department of Health to establish a public awareness campaign about HPV and its link to cervical cancer. And this bill was first introduced in the committee, and the committee had some debate about it, and the bill was tabled on a Friday afternoon. The media picked up on that tabling of the bill, and there was a lot of media attention over the weekend on this legislation. Came back into committee on Monday. Representative Karen Morgan, who sponsored the bill, was able to get the committee to look at the bill again. And they did. The initial bill that had been tabled was looking for $100,000 to fund this public awareness campaign. When they came back on Monday, they were able to get it out of committee with $25,000 for a public awareness campaign, and that went to the floor of the House for vote. It did end up passing the House, and in between this time, Representative Morgan received a letter as she's on the floor of the House, which came to her, and it was from John Huntsman Sr., who is the founder of the Huntsman Cancer Institute, and in it was a copy of a check that he had given to the Department of Health for $1 million for education and for the vaccine. And so she was obviously blown away by this news, just overwhelmed that he would take the time to look at this issue. And she spoke with him, and he was very supportive of the comments that she had made in the media over that past weekend, that every woman's life was precious and deserved to be saved, no matter how she contracted the virus. That was what her comments were as part of the media. And so he personally donated that $1 million to the Department of Health for this public awareness campaign. And there's a website with all of the materials that they have produced through this public awareness campaign. There's radio spots, television spots, posters, et cetera, now available. So I just wanted to share that story with you. It's not a regular occurrence, obviously, but it is something that one of our members worked very hard on and was recognized in her community for her efforts. I want to just bring up the Indiana legislation as well, because this is the prime example of how challenges can be turned into opportunities. In Indiana, State Senator Connie Lawson, another member and former chair of a board of Women in Government, introduced a school requirement legislation last year and came into a lot of debate and was unable to get that legislation passed. But instead, she was able to negotiate and talk with her colleagues, and they were able to pass a bill that is an educational campaign It's a collaboration between the Department of Education and the Department of Health in Indiana, and it requires the Department of Education to distribute information on HPV, its link to cervical cancer, and the availability of an HPV vaccine to parents of all sixth grade girls in the state of Indiana. So just another example. And then New Mexico is one of the examples of where legislation passed for insurance coverage of the vaccine. As Sarah mentioned, our state legislative task force that meets annually does issue policy recommendations. And I just wanted to, I won't read these for you, but just give you a little bit of an overview of what these touch upon. The first, obviously, is collaboration among all stakeholders. And as Sarah mentioned, this is a very important proponent of the campaign. It wouldn't be possible for any of this legislation to be passed or for any efforts on cervical cancer to make any headway without collaborative efforts of all stakeholders. The second, regarding routine vaccination of all girls and women who are eligible for the vaccine. The third, that states should consider school requirements in accordance with existing opt-out exemptions in their state. Insurance coverage, as I mentioned, not only for screening but for the vaccine as well. Making sure that public health programs are adequately funded, particularly to reach uninsured and underinsured women and girls to reduce health disparities. Moving forward in that area that I talked about with regard to health insurance as well. And lastly, education and awareness, which is critical. You know, one of the things we always say is you look at studies that were done, public opinion polling that was done back in the early 2000s, and not many people knew about HPV. So one of the things that's kind of another turning a challenge into an opportunity is that there was a lot of media coverage over the last year about the HPV vaccine. And while all of that was about different issues with regard to legislation, school requirements, et cetera, it did significantly increase awareness of HPV and its link to cervical cancer. So I think there's a lot of positive outcomes of some, you know, challenging situations that have happened over the last year. And I'll just close by saying that the full 2008 report is available online on our website at womeningovernment.org/prevention/state report. So thank you very much.
Sure. There's a lot on there. So one of the first things I'd say is that I'd be happy to either get you a copy of the map too, or it's on our website. And one of the things we have is a spreadsheet that goes behind that map that'll go in detail of what each piece of legislation is. I'm not sure we have time for me to go through every piece, but I'd be happy to jump up and do an overview.
Maybe talk about some of the different kinds of laws and what the code is, and then people could maybe read it on the slide.
Sure. I know it's kind of a little hard to see, but I had mentioned you'll see that there's both, for each of the different categories, there's introduced and enacted different symbols for the different stages of where the legislation are, whether they passed or not, or if they're hanging in a committee. So again, we had the school requirement. You can see that. Katie had mentioned Virginia, D.C. Okay, this is a complete overview of all of the cervical cancer activity. Are you asking about just the school requirement? That's in there. Those are the grades from our state report.
I think it's the one in Katie's
presentation. Is this the one you're referring to? Okay, and this is just HPV vaccine school requirements, so it's not the other. Yeah, and just 2007.
And it was introduction.
This is just a school requirement. This is just a map on school requirement.
If this is introduction, not necessarily action.
Introduce legislation. Right. Many of those states that did introduce it, it's the bills are dead. So as Jack had mentioned, maybe people will be bringing those back up. Not all the legislatures were in session this year. Some had sessions where they were in session, but they couldn't, you know, open the budget up again. So it really is state by state. But there are certainly legislators that I know that I think that will go back around and work on this again if it didn't pass in their states. I think there are others that will wait.
We get the
absolutely. Well, not necessarily in pushing it. I think every organization has their own recommendations or policies, and you know, and what they endorse or do not endorse at a legislative level. But we certainly try to get them a part of the dialogue, and through the 20 or so conferences we do that include cervical cancer, we try to engage them in that. And we are DC based, and a lot of those groups have DC affiliates or are based in DC as well. So we try to connect with them. But I know each of those groups has their own statement about school requirements, about HPV vaccine, et cetera.
So what's your organization's
position? On school requirement? Yeah, and I could pull these up for you too again. Our organization, it's number third bullet on here, so you can read the full official statement. We think states should consider a school requirement. We think that history has shown that it's an effective way to reach those who need vaccines the most. And I think that what we've learned, we've clearly learned some important lessons, and that is that one size does not fit all. Not all states are ready for this. And I think it will be an interesting thing to look at in 2009. Clearly, women in government has our work cut out for us. We have an election this year. We'll have new legislators who have never even heard of HPV again to educate from square one. So I think 2009 will proved to be a very interesting year. Sure, a couple of things. The first thing I would mention is I really encourage you to look at that spreadsheet we have on the website, because each piece of legislation, even if it is a school requirement, they're all different. One of the key things is that a lot of the states introduced this, but it was with delayed implementation. So not until the 2009 or even 2010 school year. So I think a lot of those, the legislation may have come early, but the actual implementation was going to still wait a couple of years, a few years even, to see what other data came out, to get the education. A lot of the states just didn't even have, obviously, the infrastructure yet to reach the people that need the information, to educate the parents, et cetera. To be honest with you, I think a lot of that information doesn't end up in the media. What are the details of the bill? What does it actually include? And it looks like a sort of one piece of legislation, but a lot of states did have variations on that. I think that certainly was a lesson learned in needing to get out there and educate people. I think Katie mentioned Representative Morgan and her message about we need to save women's lives. And to be honest with you, we work with such an amazing group of women state legislators who really want to help, and they jumped on this issue. A vaccine for a cancer, they were on top of it. Again, in some states, education was needed first, and we're going back and trying to do that. Do you want me to go?
Okay, I think the question is how do we expect all this to play out, given that we expect there to be a second HPV vaccine that may be licensed perhaps next year, and certainly it is our understanding that Merck is planning on pursuing licensure for boys or for young men for their HPV vaccine. And how do you all see that interplaying in the policy area?
Sure.
Just is that the question?
Yeah. Thank you. A couple of things. I think we always get the question about men from the state legislators. One of the first things that comes up in programs we do about cervical cancer. A big thing as a state legislator is cost effectiveness and whether it's really going to make financial sense to vaccinate boys. And I don't know that we have all those answers right now, but that's something that we're going to have to tackle with legislators on who's receiving a benefit from it and what does that look like for states that have limited, very, very finite amounts of money. The second piece I'd say is it's a complicated thing with another vaccine possibly being approved. I think it's better in the public and in the media whenever you have more than one company with an approved product. But I think that diversity in the market will help the messaging and some of the issues and barriers we've seen come up in the last year. But it's a question that I think we're all trying to figure out right now.
And certainly, I think in terms of program implementation, having a second HPV vaccine will make things complicated in ways that we haven't really dealt with yet. So it will be interesting as that one plays out. Yes. Could you let us know the URL for where that report is?
The URL is health
or www.health.state.mn.us and forward slash and then write vaccines and then you'll see HPV. Immunize, I'm sorry. slash immunize. Slash immunize.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that information. Certainly, again, when Dr. Rodewald and I have attended the meetings with women in government, I think we saw that one of the things that we could share with the legislators attending those meetings was these complexities from the point of view of program implementation and what it means to implement vaccines. And there really has been an enormous amount of interest among membership in the group in the implementation issues as well as the financing issues. So we have tried to share some of that, and we've also encouraged them in our presentations to reach out to their state health department, you know, understanding that in every state it's different in terms of to whether the health department will be allowed to engage in any kind of proactive way at all, to what degree the state health department will be willing to really work with the legislator or be able to work with the legislators on these issues. So we have tried to convey some of that, but your points are well taken, and I'm sure having that report online will be helpful to other states.
The majority of our school requirements have been passed by the department by rule.
So not legislated.
Not legislated.
I think that's true in many states, that it's a rulemaking process.
We have a law that actually delegates that authority to the department. So
then what does that mean for women in government in terms of trying to handle this with the legislature?
There has been a lot of success in recent years by manufacturers working and other advocates working through legislatures in pursuit of the funding as well. For example, in the 78th legislature in Texas, actually not the 79th, we actually had Prevnar, PCV7, and hepatitis A. We had an exceptional item, which is our department's way of requesting funding going through, and the manufacturers started a requirement so that the two would go parallel through the legislature. We did have the conscientious exemption already in place, and as a result of that legislative session, some manufacturers started using the exemption in states where there was no exemption as a way to sell this to the general public. Put a conscientious exemption in along with the new requirement for a new vaccine, and it will be more palatable to the general public.
Yeah. And that certainly has been one of the concerns I've heard expressed by many states, is that in order to make this particular vaccine requirement palatable to people for whom otherwise might not might oppose it actively, that having loosening of exemption processes and to what degree that might erode other requirements. Claire
Hannon from the Association of Immunization Managers. We actually have that data. I don't have it on me, but the majority of states can add a vaccine to their school requirement without having legislation. They can do it through a rulemaking process of their health department. And most of them have a process in place where they have an advisory committee, and they go through and they look at all the data, and they look at all the, you know, Washington State even has criteria that they look at in order to add a requirement. I think there are about 13 states that require legislation. But we, in our statement, we strongly recommend that you use the process that's in place and try to take politics out of it as much as possible.
Okay, thanks, Claire.
Sure. Well, I think that's certainly a challenge, and a lot of legislators had a lot of questions about what insurance companies in their states were covering the vaccine. And certainly, in January of 2007, there were
not a lot as much information available at that time as there is now about what insurance companies were covering it. And so many of them approached the insurance companies in their states to talk about it, but it's a very state-by-state specific issue. I know in Michigan, the Blues cover the majority of the patients there. And so I know that legislators there were in trying to get more information from the insurance company about what they were doing, but it is a state-by-state specific sort of situation, and I think a lot of the legislators took some initiative to contact those insurance companies to find out what was going on, and so certainly I think it's been much more worked out at this point.
Well, and of course the issue with insurance is even if the insurance companies add vaccines to their packages, those packages still have to be purchased by employers in the private sector, since they're for the most part the purchaser of insurance, and so there can be a disconnect between what is offered by the insurance company and what's actually available to the insured people.
And what we experienced is that the manufacturers or the insurance companies covered the vaccine, but what is the real issue is that especially with this vaccine and the newer vaccines that have come out, they're so expensive. The insurance companies are not reimbursing the physician their total cost. So the physicians are actually losing money every time they give this vaccine to an insured patient. And we believe that that is going to be a major legislative issue in this coming session next January.
I got the whole question. There's something going on behind us here. Our sources of funding and how that was portrayed in the media, the gist of it.
That was the question.
The gist of it. I don't think our funding is ever really accurately portrayed in the media. No one ever said that we received a CDC grant to work on cervical cancer. That was never stated anywhere. I think that's a really important piece of this. As most nonprofit organizations go, we have to go fundraise to work on the initiatives we want to carry out. So we do look to corporate and foundation and government, state, and federal sources for that. And so, we took a lot of interviews last year and tried to clear that up, and we put the whole list of our funders on our website, but, clearly we don't have any control over the media, and I certainly think that that has had repercussions for our members. They are elected officials, and, it was disheartening to us when there was an inaccurate information out there. And at the state legislative level, I think you'll come to find that, I can't speak for every woman state legislator that's working on this initiative, but most of them have not taken money from those various companies.
Are there other questions? Well, I'd like to thank all of our presenters for engaging in a really sort of frank conversation here. And do you have a question?
Not a question, Melinda, but just to clarify that the funds came from the cervical cancer programs, and no CDC funds are used to lobby ever.